You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferrand. Now, in his first inaugural address in 1981, Republican President Ronald Reagan made clear his support for the free market.
In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
And Democratic President Bill Clinton would go on to echo Reagan in his 1996 State of the Union address.
The era of big government is over.
Our next guest points toward both of those statements as examples of an economic idea that became dominant over time in the United States, market fundamentalism. That's the idea loosely that free markets can meet all of our needs, economic and otherwise, and that government regulation and intervention inevitably distorts the free market in negative ways. For many Republicans and Democrats, this theory has become very influential. But our next guest says that free market fundamentalism is a myth built over generations by American business leaders in a long-running campaign of public relations and outreach that targeted government policymakers, the education system, popular culture, and more. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What thoughts do you have? What questions do you have about the philosophy of an unregulated free market? Do you see a need for some government intervention, or is government the problem? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Naomi Oreskes is professor of science history at Harvard University. She's the co-author, along with Eric Conway, of Merchants of Doubt, How a Handful of Scientists Obscured the Truth on Issues from Tobacco Smoke to Climate Change. Their new book is The Big Myth, How American Business Taught Us to Loathe Government and Love the Free Market. Naomi, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
I gave a very nutshell version there. Can you tell us a little more about the concept of market fundamentalism that's central to your book?
Well, that was a great nutshell, and I think I could pick up with the word intervention. So you mentioned that. You asked listeners, do they believe in government intervention, or should we just let the market do its magic? But the whole notion of intervention is part of the big myth. It's based on the idea that there is something called the free market that exists unto itself, that has a kind of wisdom, and that we could simply trust it, that we can have faith in markets to do the right thing, and we don't need governments to guide the markets or set rules and regulations. And that idea is a myth, because the reality is markets are human institutions. They're created by people. They go back to time immemorial. There were markets in biblical times, and the Bible even has a discussion of certain rules and regulations for the marketplace. People have always structured markets in the ways they felt they needed to meet their needs and to prevent damage. But in the 20th century, we were persuaded to think otherwise, to think that there was such a thing as the free market that could exist on its own and that didn't need the government to set the rules of the road. And it's that myth that we challenge in our new book.
Yeah, that's the story you tell in the book, is not so much the idea itself of market fundamentalism, but how it was promoted to the point where it became, I guess, a given, almost taken for granted. What were some of the origins of this in ways a very successful public relations campaign?
Well, the book begins in the early 20th century with debates that took place over child labor and something that was known as the accident crisis. So many people have forgotten or maybe never knew that capitalism in the early 20th century was incredibly dangerous. One out of every 1,000 workers was killed or seriously injured on the job every year. And that was the equivalent of 1.5 million people today. So imagine if it would be like a pandemic, a COVID pandemic every year of workplace death. And so this led to a big discussion about whether government should play a role in regulating workplaces to make them safer, and especially why there were so many more deaths in the United States than there were in Germany and the United Kingdom, which were also heavily industrialized countries. And the answer people realized was workmen's compensation, that these other countries had insurance programs where the amount that an employer had to pay into the insurance's premium depended on how dangerous their workplace were. So programs of workmen's compensation not only protected workers and their families, but also created an incentive for owners, for managers to clean up their act. And so a big debate took place about whether or not the United States should do the same. Many reformers thought the answer was yes. Teddy Roosevelt thought the answer was yes. Andrew Carnegie thought the answer was yes. But a small group of business people began to create an argument, the argument that we trace in our book, that the answer was no, because if the government, quote, intervened, and that's the word they use, if the government intervened or interfered in the marketplace, it was a threat to freedom. And that's the story that we trace in the book all the way through Ronald Reagan, Bill Clinton, and to the present day.
Naomi Oreskes is with us. She's the co-author of the new book, The Big Myth, How American Business Taught Us to Loathe Government and Love the Free Market. And with those earliest stories, you start with child labor, workers' compensation, rural electrification. You see themes emerge that come up, as you say, to the present day. One of them that comes up a lot, and this is in the child labor debate, I think, was something along the lines of Soviet Russia, the communists are trying to do away with child labor. If we do that in America, it's one step toward communism.
Exactly. And this is a key part of the argument. It's red baiting. It's to say that anyone who points out any of the failures of capitalism, whether it's child labor, workplace injury, the failure of the electricity industry to supply consumers in rural areas, that anyone who points out these facts, these realities about the way capitalism is operating, get accused of being communist. And this, of course, is something that we see again to the present day. People who supported Medicare in the 1960s, people who supported Obamacare in the 2000s, people who support the expansion of Medicare today get accused of being socialists or communists. And this is a way of shutting down the discussion and making it seem as if the only choices we have are completely unregulated capitalism run amok, or Soviet-style totalitarianism. And so a lot of the propaganda, the public relations that we document in the book set up this false dichotomy and make people think, or it's designed to make people think, that if you allow the government to address a problem like Medicare, for example, that you're on a slippery slope to Soviet-style communism, we lose all our freedom, and we're living in a new dark era.
A part of that outreach, and I thought this was interesting, targeted the education system at all levels. What were some of the earliest examples of, I guess, textbook wars over how we talk about the free market?
Yeah, and this is really interesting given what's going on in America today over textbooks. So one of the stories we tell in the book is about how the electricity industry tried to fight back against reform by distorting textbooks. So there was a group in the 1920s called the National Electric Light Association. This was a trade organization representing electrical utilities and the manufacturers of electrical equipment like Westinghouse. What critics pointed out was that the electricity industry had supplied electricity to urban consumers, people in places like St. Louis and Chicago, but had utterly failed to provide electricity to rural consumers. And this was a clear example of a failure, a market failure, a failure of supply and demand, because rural customers were demanding electricity. They wanted electricity, and many people thought they needed it even more, like farmers needed electricity even more than urbanites did, but they didn't have it. And they didn't have it because the industry refused to supply it because they didn't think that they could make enough profit. And so a group of reformers started arguing that the government should step in to remedy this market failure. In response, the industry launched a massive propaganda campaign. And it was propaganda. They were later investigated by the Federal Trade Commission, who called this the largest peacetime propaganda campaign in U.S. history. And the campaign was designed not just to persuade people that the electricity industry was great and we could trust them, but to change the way we thought about capitalism, to persuade us that any government action in the marketplace was a threat to freedom. And they did this by paying academics to rewrite textbooks, high school textbooks, college textbooks, to promote free enterprise capitalism, to promote an anti-government, pro-market ideology, and then pressuring publishers to adopt these new textbooks, sending free copies of the textbooks to thousands and thousands of libraries across the United States, supporting it with lecture series of paid, basically, shills who would shill for the industry, to persuade us that we just needed to trust the magic of the marketplace and everything would be fine.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Kurt is with us in Chippewa Falls. Kurt, hi.
Yes, I really empathize and sympathize with the point that the author, I guess, is making. And I would like to point out that this is by no means something that had merely gone on in the past or the previous century, but is going on today. In fact, there is a private college in Michigan that boasts about being totally free of government, any kind of government, federal government support or aid, and it is promoting a nationwide course called Constitution 101, which claims that the free market is embedded in our U.S. Constitution.
Kurt, thanks for that call. Naomi, that is a theme you bring up your book, the idea that the free market is a fundamental part of American society.
Exactly. And I did not plant that call, but that was just a perfect call. Thank you so much for that, because that's exactly right. And that's part of the reason we wrote this book. This isn't just of historical interest. It's important because these arguments continue today, and they're being used even as we speak to justify rolling back protections for child labor, protections for workers, protections for unions. And I assume that the caller was referring to Hillsdale College. I get emails from Hillsdale College. They're very interesting. One of Ronald Reagan's most important speeches was a speech he gave at Hillsdale College, and we talk about that in the book.
Thanks for that call, Kurt. We're talking to Naomi Oreskes, professor of science history at Harvard University, co-author of the new book we're talking about. It's called The Big Myth: How American Business Taught Us to Loathe Government and Love the Free Market. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your reactions to what you've heard from our guests so far, how you think it does or doesn't fit the present day. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Naomi Oreskes, professor of science history at Harvard University, co-author along with Eric Conway of the new book, The Big Myth: How American Business Taught Us to Loathe Government and Love the Free Market. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest, your thoughts on the balance between the government regulating business, banks, worker safety, and more. How much is too much? Call 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Elizabeth is with us in Eau Claire. Elizabeth, hi.
Hi there. Well, I appreciate the author's dichotomy word, because I totally agree there should be a balance. But I want to give two examples, an old one and a new one, of maybe where government does play a role in safety. One was the shirtwaist factory fire, which is in the early 1900s, when all these young women burned to death because the doors, the exit doors, were locked. They either burned or jumped out windows from the ninth floor, and I don't remember how many, but there were lots. And the other one would be more modern day, would be the Palestine train accident recently, I think in Kentucky.
In Ohio,
when the train engineers didn't have enough. They were too tired, often too long hours, and there were too many cars to this train and several other things I don't remember. So,
Elizabeth, I gotcha, referring there to the train derailment in Ohio. Thanks for the call, Elizabeth. Naomi, Elizabeth giving a couple cases where she thinks obviously some regulation might have helped.
Well, exactly. And one of the things we point out in the book, and we actually talk about the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory, because that was a very famous and important example that helped to support stronger workplace safety mechanisms. Almost all of the rules and regulations that conservatives, libertarians, and others have attacked in recent years were put in place in response to problems like the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory, to real problems in the way in which our economy was operating and the need for government to redress the balance. That the private sector had proven that you couldn't just trust them to regulate themselves. You couldn't trust businesses to create safe workplaces, that you needed government, you needed supervision, or another way of thinking of it is that the market needed rules of the road. So nobody objects to stop signs and red lights. Well, maybe some people do, but most of us recognize that stop signs and red lights and speed limits are necessary to keep us all safe and to enable us to drive on the road. Limited entrance ramps on freeways actually enable us to drive faster. So rules and regulations can actually be enabling. But in recent years, in the last 40 years or so, and you heard those clips at the beginning of Ronald Reagan and Bill Clinton, the dominant ideology has been one of saying that regulations are bad and that the government just needs to, quote, get out of the way. And that's just not true. History doesn't support that ideology. And so we wanted to explain, well, why do so many people, including both Democrats and Republicans, buy into this idea, which is clearly false, not supported by the facts of history? And the answer we show is, to a very great extent, a long, complicated, and well-funded propaganda campaign.
Thanks for that call, Elizabeth. Tom joins us now in Milwaukee. Tom, hello.
Hi. I have a recollection just from the last few months of someone saying that the story Little House on the Prairie, when it was depicted on the television series in different forms, that actually the daughter of the author rewrote those things and made it free market friendly to promote that subtly.
I believe, Tom, thanks for the call. I believe, Naomi, that is something you tackle in the book.
Yes, that is a chapter in our book. So one of the things we show in the book is how these ideas were propagandized in a wide variety of contexts, including textbooks, including film, television, radio, and children's books. And the most astonishing story is the story of the Little House on the Prairie books, which I and millions of other American girls grew up thinking were the true life stories of Laura Ingalls Wilder on the American frontier. They were marketed that way. They were pitched that way. But in fact, the books were actually written by her daughter, Rose Wilder Lane, who was a libertarian, an extreme libertarian ideologue, a friend of Herbert Hoover, a correspondent of J. Howard Pugh, the president of Sun Oil Corporation. Lane, Hoover, Pugh, and others worked to promote libertarian ideology in America. And one of the things they did, one of the things she did, was to rewrite her mother's stories as libertarian parables.
Tom, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Naomi Oreskes, co-author of the new book, The Big Myth, How American Business Taught Us to Loathe Government and Love the Free Market. I want to focus in on this particular marketplace, Naomi, the marketplace of ideas. And you look at the influence of business and money in promoting scholars and authors and others who promoted the ideas you're talking about. Can you talk about how that swayed the messages people might have heard?
Exactly. Well, the Little House story is the most heartbreaking, and the academic story is the most infuriating. So we like to believe, and certainly I, as a Harvard professor, would like to believe that academia is a kind of refuge where ideas win or lose based on the solidity of the ideas, the evidence behind them. But what we show in the book is that the marketplace of ideas was grossly distorted by a group of business leaders with links to the National Association of Manufacturers, a major trade organization, and the DuPont Corporation, who paid the University of Chicago to hire a key neoliberal thinker, Friedrich von Hayek, an Austrian economist, and to set up a project at the University of Chicago called the Free Market Project. And the specific point of this project was to develop a blueprint for a free market or free enterprise-based America. They paid academics to write books, to write articles supporting free market against the enforcement of antitrust litigation. And perhaps most egregiously, one of the members of this project, the economist George Stigler, published an edited version of Adam Smith, which grossly distorted Adam Smith's argument, stripping out all of the places in The Wealth of Nations where he argues for regulation, for the role of government, for the rights of workers, and gives us this very distorted view of Adam Smith. But it's the view of Adam Smith that many, perhaps most people in America hold today.
Your book covers a 100-year-plus history up to the present day. Naomi, what are you hoping people take from this book and do with it in 2023?
Well, the main thing I hope, I'm happy to say, is already happening, which is a conversation. What we really want is not to try to persuade people what the right balance between government and private enterprise is, but to have a conversation about what that balance should be. Because we believe the balance is way off kilter in the United States, that we have excessively weakened the regulations that protect us as consumers, as workers, weakened the regulations that protect us against bank failure. We've seen that clearly this week. And that there is an important, essential role for government in protecting workers, protecting the environment, dealing with climate change. But we've been hamstrung in having that conversation. We've been hamstrung in using the powers that we have, even the laws that are on the books to address something like climate change, because of the dominance of free market ideology. And we think that if people come to understand that a lot of this was propaganda, a lot of this is not supported by the evidence of history, it will help us to have a better, more nuanced, and in the end of the day, well, a better conversation, and hopefully in the long run, more effective public policy.
Naomi, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Been talking to Naomi Oreskes, professor of science history at Harvard University, co-author of the book we've been talking about, The Big Myth, How American Business Taught Us to Loathe Government and Love the Free Market. Well, she ended with a kind of a question there. What is the right balance in any particular part of the U.S. economy versus leaving it to private enterprise versus government involvement? Love to hear your answers to that question. Maybe something that affects you in a part of your life or your work, or something you'd like to hear discussed more specifically, whether it's a healthcare policy, workplace safety, you name it, let us know, and maybe we can tackle a future conversation about it. You could email us. You can do this anytime, but you can even email us right now, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Let us know your thoughts on the balance between a private enterprise and government regulation and what you want to hear more about. That's ideas@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.